Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, pop culture historian Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong stops by to discuss her latest book, Parks and Rec, the underdog TV show that literally inspired a vision for a better America. This conversation originally took place April 22nd, 2026, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Thank you all for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. From its beginning as the story of a hole in the ground, the sitcom Parks and Recreation has become a cultural touchstone, streamed and beloved and quoted incessantly as our need for an optimistic vision of government only grows. Pop culture historian Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong tells the story of how the show almost didn't come to be and why it's so groundbreaking now. Jennifer's written 9 books, including the New York Times bestseller Seinfeldia, Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted, and When Women Invented Television. She's co-founder of the Ministry of Pop Culture newsletter and a former local newspaper reporter here in the Chicago area. Please join me in welcoming her to the AWM.
Allison always does the best introductions of all the places. So thank you.
Thank you.
And we were local newspaper reporters together, which might come up.
Yeah. Yeah. We might start telling some war stories. So I wanted to start by talking about the show's depiction of government. Because you talk in the book about how, you know, the majority of shows focus on law enforcement and first responders and firefighters. Those are the public sector jobs that get TV shows, while the city council members are often the foils for those positions. Like, they're these vain, corrupt clowns that the cops have to like find ways around, and they're portrayed really negatively. But this show kind of turned that on its head. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I actually cite some studies. I promise I won't like cite studies right now, but I do cite some studies toward the end of the book that were, it tells you what you know, but I hadn't really thought a lot about, which is you don't see a lot of public service, period, on television. And the vast majority that you do see is cops and lawyers. And we all know that, but it was interesting to me to see that quantified. And what's funny is that all the things they say almost no one does on television in the study, Parks does all of them. And they have a whole list. It's like public officials, competent public officials, voting behavior. This is how, you know, it sounds in studies. This is how they say things. They literally do every single one of these things. I would say I get it, because it's really actually quite hard to do in an entertaining way. This is just a fluke of a show that has such, like, Mike Schur, the creator, has such love for public government, which is like not a normal thing at all. And for a especially for a person in Hollywood, he's like, gets his first shot. And he's like, what I really want to do is make a show about local government officials. You and I know the drama that can ensue and absolutely the humor that can ensue. It's a wacky world because most people don't care about it, honestly, because most people aren't looking. So, you know, it is full of wacky characters and difficult things. It's like difficult tasks that, you know, we see often for Leslie putting on a harvest festival, even just chairing a meeting, you know, that kind of thing. So that was the challenge that they took on and did a great job. But it is an absolute miracle that there was ever a show about a small town government. That's my feeling. You're not going to see this a lot more times. And it's only because he was coming from The Office, and it was, The Office was huge at that very moment, and NBC was begging for another show, and they were like, how about this shiny little object, how about this sexy show about local government officials. So I just think it was such a miracle that it was able to happen, and I'm grateful for that.
They initially wanted a spin-off of The Office, is that correct?
Yes, very, very, very badly. This was, if you were around then and watching television, you remember that there was a time in the 2000s when like The Office was it. It was like the hottest thing, because it felt new, it felt fresh. You know, no one no one had done mockumentary in a in a TV show. It was based on The Office from England, of course, but like they brought the mockumentary format into the sitcom. It was a little, it was like a weird combination of like sort of sweet, but also very cringy. It was regular people, which was kind of, it's kind of an interesting thing. It's not sexy doctors or sexy lawyers, basically.
Or sexy cops.
Or sexy cops. or sexy teens,
yeah,
for that matter. It was just like regular people who were very relatable, I think, to a regular person who went to a job every day. And so that, and the fact that that became the biggest thing was like, and NBC did not have a lot else going for it. So Ben Silverman, who was in charge at NBC at the time, begged. He had helped bring The Office over, and he was like, I need, and at first Greg Daniels, who was the Office guy, he is the guy who brought The Office over and adapted it and was in charge of it. And so he really was begging Greg, and Greg didn't really want to do it at first, because like, I don't know if any creative types are like dying to do a spinoff. Like it's kind of, it's not that exciting. You know, Joni Loves Chachi, or like, if you think about, some spinoffs have been great. Like Lou Grant was a spinoff, and you just forget after a while if it's good. But most of the time that's kind of seen as like this cheesy, like way of making more money. And he really didn't want to take any of the characters off. You know, you're not going to have a Jim and Pam Office spinoff, because then you have no Office. Yeah. And then the other risk is you take a minor character who you think is great, and then you bring them over and you find out they don't really hold up. They have like two wacky traits, and
they're grating after a while. Yeah.
Their best contender, this is for the Office nerds in the room, but their best contender for an idea for this was that they were going to have Andy Bernard get married, and that it would be like the most average family in America, and they would do like a mockumentary about his most average family in America in the most average place, which is kind of part of why they came up with Pawnee eventually. So that was their idea. And what's funny is that a year or two later, Modern Family happened, and that was not them, and they are still bitter. Because they were never able to do their family idea. But they really were resisting. So he picked Mike Schur out of his writer's room to kind of do this project with him. And they kept coming up with ideas. They didn't like any of them. But they had this government idea, which obviously didn't really have anything to do with The Office. And one of my favorite things that I learned for the book was that they were joking that the way they'd make it a spinoff is that like a copy machine would be shipped from like the office and go and be in Pawnee, and that therefore it would be a spinoff.
That's the connection.
That's the only crossover character. But instead they went the other way. And another thing that I found really interesting and good trivia is that they cast Rashida Jones pretty early on Parks and Rec. And the reason they liked that was that she had played a character, Karen, on The Office. And they were like, this way they can never make us be a spin. Like, you know how they could maybe do something later where they're like, surprise.
But she'd play,
you know, Michael Scott's going to visit Pawnee. And this way, because she was playing a different character, they were like, they can never make us be a spinoff of any. We're not in the same universe. This officially cut it off. So they were pretty like stealthily actually rebelling actively. Like they had been given carte blanche to make a show.
Yeah.
And then they just did not want to cooperate with what NBC actually wanted. And I find it fascinating that truly more than a decade later, Ben Silverman said, like, he's still a little bitter that they didn't do a spinoff. He said, I still think it would have worked better. Everyone would have watched it. It would have been better for both shows. He also did not last long at NBC. He was fired like a year later. So this whole thing became
moot. Judgment.
Yeah, well, he actually may have had good TV judgment. He's an interesting character in and of himself. You can look into that later. I have a little bit of that in here. He once had famously at a party in Hollywood with like women in bikinis and white tigers, and he was like, he would like badmouth his fellow network presidents. He was like a network bad boy.
Oh no.
He was like the Maxim magazine of network presidents.
Oh God, the early 2000s.
The 2000s were a time.
A dark time. But this show really, you know, kind of charted its own course. And, you know, you mentioned a minute ago that, you know, they found humor in so much about local government that can be frustrating or boring, or like, I'm thinking particularly about any scene that involves public comment at a town meeting. Who here has been there waiting? Anybody to get, yeah, to for your item on the agenda to come up, but there's somebody there, but there's the local character who needs to talk for his 2 minutes.
Yep.
About chemtrails. Mm-hmm. So like, they found all of these, they took all these mundane things and they made them really funny and also really sweet.
Yeah, and you'll see even in the first episode, and I noticed in a lot of the early reviews of that first episode, they note this, and it is clearly the highlight of that. They were still finding their footing in the first episode, but there is a public meeting. And everyone did love the public meeting, including me as a person who had been to many public meetings. And this came out of Greg and Mike had done a fair amount of research for this, and they had attended a bunch of LA City Council meetings, and they said they were flabbergasted because they hadn't really like done this before. They were like, they just have to listen to these people. Yeah. It's like, that's fascinating that there's this little corner of American democracy where it's like everyone, like, there is a thing called public comment. It doesn't have to do with the agenda. You can get up and you get places tend to do 2 or 3 minutes.
Yeah.
And you will often, like you said, you'll get certain, we used to call them gadflies, right?
Yeah.
Who will just show up at every single meeting. I remember one at a town I covered where it was like every time it was about the egrets, she was always worried about the egrets in the Newport Bay. And she was just going to, Jan's going to talk about the egrets. That's just what's going to happen. And so, I mean, if you're the person who has to listen to it, it's not always great, but you have to admit it's a little bit lovely to think that there's like a place somewhere where you can go and get your 3 minutes other than an open mic, which is another alternative. And they loved that and they were fascinated by it. And they also saw the obvious humor in that. This actually reminds me of a fun concept that they mentioned. Greg is very nerdy about writing comedy, and he names his concepts. And one of his comedy concepts is a killing field. And the idea is that, like, if you get all of your characters in a room, especially these sort of improv-based shows, where, and they're all just killer improvers, you can think of this in The Office too. Like, if there's an office meeting, or there's a council or whatever, a town meeting in Pawnee, the idea is you just fill the audience or the room full of like incredible improvers and give them a mission. And then the killing field is just that you can just go and go and go. And it's like, this person has this reaction and this reaction and this reaction. And if you think of like Michael Scott in The Office at the front of a meeting, and then all the different characters have reactions that are hilarious. Like, that's so they thought this would be a great killing field for the show. And I think that that proved to be correct.
It was very funny, but it was also even really early on, it was also very sincere. You are not supposed to look down on these people for any, you know, for caring about their community. It's one of those shows that really likes all of its characters, even the really obnoxious ones, maybe especially them. And you could see that in how the people involved with the show talk to you in this book. Like, everyone loved talking about this show.
Honestly, I felt a little, I was like, I mean, I don't want to make this actually happen, but I was like, I should maybe just hang it up after this, because I've written about Sex and the City, Seinfeld, the Mary Tyler Moore Show. Mary Tyler Moore Show came close with this, but I've never, and I covered tons of shows when I worked at Entertainment Weekly magazine. So I've been on lots of sets. I know how this, I've been on some very tense sets. But this, man, it was like a spiritual experience just getting to talk to people about it. Like, Mike Schur at the end of our first interview was like, you can call me back. Like, it was very like, he was like, I love talking about this. Like, they all, Adam Scott struck me as particularly like wistful about it. Like, he would kind of look off and be like, he said something so beautiful. He said something like, we would just get out of bed every morning. I'd just jump out of bed every morning, so excited to go to work. And the other story I do want to tell that really illustrates this is that they started a bit. So they took a photo where they were dressed maybe very similarly to us now. Like, they were, a lot of them were in suits because Leslie was running for office. They happened to take a picture of a bunch of them on set, and they were like, we look like we're on a law show. And then they were like, it's called Philly Justice. And then they like started filling out their characters. And then they were like, but Dylan McDermott would probably be on this. He was on The Practice. Yeah. They're like, but would you starring Dylan McDermott? And we'd all be like supporting characters. So then like Adam Scott made a fake Dylan McDermott email address. It was like dylanmcdermott74@gmail.com. And he would like sign off from his own and sign on and like email everybody and be like, I can't wait to join you guys for Philly Justice. It goes so much farther. They made t-shirts and some other swag. And then the crazy thing was, they had kind of mentioned this to me, and I was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And it had been out in public a little bit before. But then Catherine Hahn, who plays Jen Barkley, when I interviewed her, she was like, well, it was crazy when Dylan came to the set. And I was like, I'm sorry, what? She's like, don't you, like, Dylan came to the set and we shot a promo. I was like, what are you talking about? Like, another actor came to your set and like didn't get paid, and you were like, hey, we've been doing a bit. And then someone wrote a script
for your fake show,
for your fake promo. And then, so it does exist and you can see it online, but they're all in wigs and other outfits. And they shot a whole, I was like, I don't believe you, Catherine Hahn. Like, just because I was like, this still makes no sense. So she's like, no, I'm telling you, ask Morgan, who's a producer on the show. So I emailed Morgan and I was like, does this exist? Because I feel like I can't just write, I don't believe her. And he's like, hold on. He's a master. And truly a day later, he was like, please don't put this online. And then he sent it to
someone.
And it existed. So yeah, this happened. I tell this story because it's crazy, but also because that is such a crazy level of like wanting to hang out together. Like, these people are working 12-hour days as it is. Most people on most shows, even if they like each other, are like, when they're wrapped, they're out. You know, like, they're like, I'm going home to my kids, whatever. Yeah. These people stayed extra. I still don't, who shot it? I'm still
just
not
to
clear.
Like shoot
just
the breeze
with each
other.
And then they wrote the thing and they made a thing, and for no reason. And it hasn't been public until fairly recently. So it wasn't like for something or it's to show everybody. It was just for them. Yeah. And that's the level that they loved, like making each other laugh. That's how much they loved being together. And I think that's extraordinary.
I mean, they're a bunch of kids at summer camp is what
that's,
it sounds like. Or the army.
So that's such a good,
they're
such a good
like,
way of thinking.
They're all, you know, they're all away for this one special, you know, it's this special time that really hit all of them at a critical point in their careers, though.
You know, they were also, I would say, on average to a lot of casts that kind of hit it big, a little older. They were probably an average of 35 to 40. And I think that was so important because they got it. They understood how lucky they were. A lot of times if you're like on a teen show or whatever, you're like, oh, I hate this. And everybody just wants me to talk about this character and this sucks. These people were like, this is incredible. We cannot believe we've found this many people. And the fact is they also worked really hard to have a great working environment, as you and I were talking about earlier. And a lot of people say they have a no assholes policy, but they don't really. These people did. They only wanted to work with people who were great. And every single person who came on the show, they knew was great. You know, they bring Paul Rudd in, who's like been best friends with a variety of the, like, this is very cute to me. Like, he's been best friends with Adam Scott since high school. I know. They're like little puppies, aren't they?
Babies.
It was really hard for me not to actually go like, oh. When they said, I was like, I'm sorry, I know you're a grown man, but oh, oh my God, that's so cute. They went to acting school together. Oh my God. But like they knew, and Rudd had worked with several other people, you know, they all kind of would crowdsource good people to bring in. And if somebody wasn't good, they were not there for very long.
Yeah. And you had this, it wasn't just a rule that they talked about, it was something they enforced.
I think that's extraordinary, and I'm not sure everybody even can do it. Like, I don't know why Mike Schur has, because how do you know? You often meet somebody and be like, they're great. And then 3 weeks in, you're like,
Not so much.
But Amy and Mike said that they talked about this when they decided to make the show together. And for some reason, they just have really good judgment about people. And those two are really good people. And it just worked. And I also have a theory, though, that like if you have enough good people and the top, you know, Amy's the top of the call sheet, as they say. And she imagine. So my thing is like, are you going to be a jerk to Amy Poehler?
Under no circumstances.
Right. So even if you are a jerk in other circumstances, maybe you're not a jerk on the set of Parks because there's like good peer pressure. It's like peer pressure to be a good person.
And there was such a culture of I don't want to let my friends down. I don't want to let my coworkers down. I want to go
Yes.
110% because these people are all counting on me.
Yeah, and people do talk about like Amy's very generous with her laughs. If you've listened to her podcast, you kind of get this too. She has a great laugh, and people would kind of almost be like, I just want her to laugh at what I'm going to do. You know, like, I want to get that laugh, but she's also very generous with it. And so that encourages people. So I think a huge part too is that feeling of like setting the tone on your set and then just getting the right people. They were just, this is any show that rises to the level of getting a book written about it. Usually has reached some level of like magical casting that you just don't get there without. They may not like each other. I did write a book about Sex in the City. Did a great job while they were on the air.
They worked.
But this, we were not having that conversation about this cast. They weren't jumping out of bed in the morning and running to work all the time. So this just, and I think personally, like the mood of the show, everything ends up working together. Like, part of the reason, like that comes through. You know, you're watching people who love each other and have fun together. And they talked so much about wanting to make each other laugh. And there is a lot, there's like, it is scripted, but there's a fair amount of improv. They would do things called fun runs, which is like once they knew they had the scene, they'd do like a couple more takes where all, no holds barred.
We're just going to do it all in a chicken voice.
Do whatever you, and if you look online, you can see just reams of bloopers or outtakes or whatever you want to call them. And it's really just them like cracking up at each other's improvs. And often, well, many of which you're like, oh no, that couldn't have aired. No, we can't.
You don't use that word.
There's a Dennis Feinstein sequence in particular. Have you seen it? Do you know what I'm talking about? You can look it up later, but where they're talking about like different, he's the cologne guy, and they're like the different cologne.
That story was amazing.
Yeah, exactly. And it is so like they are cracking up so hard because it's so dirty. There's one that's called like insert and
It's really, I was reading that and I laughed so loud I scared my cat.
yeah, like the and that's often at that point in a scene, they would have the writers like on the sides yelling stuff like, try this, you know? And so, I mean, but this is all goes to show like how much, how that comes through. I really like that's the part that just some of the greatest parts and lines turned out to be those improvs. And also, how cool, wouldn't you love it if like at your job, one a part of it was that everyone was like, okay, that was great. Now let's all do a fun run. Right? Like what job can you do that at? So it was just great.
As a critic, how do you decide that something is a moment, that something is culturally significant enough? Because as you said, there's a lot of shows that don't have books about them. How do you decide that you want to write about a show?
This is my snotty answer. I'm actually super picky about it. I'm so annoying at like people love at cocktail parties because of what I do to just like, what about? Whatever. And there's shows that have had books written about them by other people that I personally just wouldn't have done because I either don't have the emotional connection and or they don't have because I'm just a nerd about like I like having that social impact part. So I always want something that has lasting effects on the actual world. It's nice to entertain people, but I actually don't know what to put in the book either if there's not that part of it. So I'm always looking for that. And actually, what's weird is sometimes you can't tell right away. Like it usually takes about 10 years before you're like, oh, now, yeah, I see it. Like I remember thinking like back in the day, I was like, I don't think I knew, why would you ever do a book on The Office? And now I'm like, there's like four books about The Office and they're all good. You know, so sometimes it takes a little while just to see if it's going to last, because things that you think are going to last sometimes don't. Sometimes they're ruined by their finale, like Game of Thrones. Sometimes, or Lost.
Or they're ruined by their fan club, like Breaking Bad.
That's right. That's right. And so, you know, there's things can happen. And so you want things to sort of, they may not completely settle, but you want to get a sense of like, hopefully nobody's going to get Me Too'd here. That's another thing. I don't want that. And then like lasting resonance. And the beautiful thing about the Parks story that just really got me, and it was actually different from the other books I've done, is that it wasn't popular when it was on. And then like it, every season it barely got through, which actually made for great storytelling in the book, which is nice for me. Cause every season it was like, how are they going to get themselves back on the air? And then they didn't, then they became one of the biggest, most streamed shows of the pandemic and afterwards. And people now are surprised to learn that this was not a huge success when it was on. Everybody's like, no, this is a classic for all time. And it's like, we could argue about this. I even feel like it's a little more resonant now than like 30 Rock. That's close. But 30 Rock was, while not a gigantic hit, compared to Parks,
much bigger.
It was much bigger. And now, and I thought like, well, 30 Rock is it. Like 30 Rock was such a hot show too, to like comedy nerds. And then I just feel like Parks is bigger in the conversation over time, maybe because 30 Rock had such so many like timely jokes. You know, there's a lot of like Jack Donaghy's dating Condi Rice type jokes. I know it's still good to me, but the kids don't get it. And something that also happened with Parks that is so interesting is I hear a lot from people that they share it with their kids. And there's not a lot of shows, current shows now. I don't know why streamers are not doing this, but that's a different story. There's not a lot of shows like this now that are like comfort watch. You said it just before when we were talking, like you can put it on in the background. If you do pay attention, it pays dividends, but you don't have to be like, it's not a mystery. It's not Lost. You can just put it on. And then also it plays at different levels. So like the wackiness plays for a 12-year-old, and then the adults can enjoy all the other parts of it. You know, you don't have to be getting every part of it. And I just don't think we have a lot of shows like that now. So people are going to this show. And so I keep like, it's popular with like college age kids because they watched it during the pandemic with their parents. A really sweet thing is that a lot of the cast watched it for the first time with their kids during the pandemic. Amy watched it with her kids during the pandemic. And I thought that was really lovely. She's like, once they got over the like watching their mom, and it's weird. She said, like, she's like, I'd never watched it really. So she was like, I would watch it and be like, what's gonna happen? How do I get out of this? I don't remember. So, you know, that's something that I heard a lot and is really great. And it's a reason that now it rises to this occasion in a way that maybe I wouldn't have thought when it first went off the air.
Well, I think we wanted to watch a little clip from the show. Well, I could talk to you about that clip alone for another 20 minutes, but I would be remiss if we did not introduce a special guest that we have here tonight. If everyone would please give a round of applause and welcome the mayor of Minooka, Rick Offerman.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for asking.
Have you ever had a political event like that?
Luckily, no.
Do you campaign or anything like that?
Luckily, no.
Okay, good. Well, we didn't talk enough about your son, actually, in that first part, but we'll do that a little bit. But first, I want to talk about you. Your family actually has a long history of being in local government in Minooka, right?
You could say that. Mm-hmm. Many times it was by accident.
Just you or the volunteers? Just.
Well, I don't know why, but some people thought that they'd like to have me in a position where they could yell and throw things, and I was dumb enough to say yes. Many, many different things. But really, just let me say, I became mayor because the former mayor said there's a couple of squirrely guys talking about running, and I think you should run and give them some competition. And then nobody ran. So that's why I didn't campaign.
Makes sense. Do you think they were just trying to trick you into doing it?
I have no idea.
Okay. I mean, this is something that does come up, though, in local government, too, as we were talking about. I mean, it's not always as glamorous as Parks and Rec makes it. There's not a ton of people who actually want to do it all the time.
That is true. So it's important for us to try to look around in town and see who's interested in the town. I just had to replace somebody on planning and zoning. And Manuka used to be a town of 400, 500 people. And now it's almost 13,000. But an awful lot of them don't even know where City Hall is. And I'm not telling you a lie there, because I have campaigned for other people over the years. They didn't know where the post office was. And it's not that hard to find.
Well, I mean, that area of Chicagoland, as we say, has really blown up over the past decade,
yes.
Maybe even 5 years.
It started about in the 1990s, but it's really blown up in the last 10 years. It's we are Southwest Chicago now. We're right on the fringe. It's hard to go toward Chicago on 55 and see a cornfield anymore.
That's true.
So
that's really true.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Did you, when you were growing up there, did you think of yourself as part of Chicago or really no?
We weren't even part of Joliet.
Not even a suburb of Joliet. Why do you think it's important to participate in local government?
Well, my dad always taught me to try to give something back to the town. The town always treated us good growing up, and it was so small. We only had 4 streets east and west and 5 streets north and south. So if you messed up on one end of town before you got home, Ma was waiting for you, and sometimes with a switch.
How far back does your family go in Manuka?
We didn't move to Manuka until 1945.
Newcomers.
Everybody thought we were. That's true. It took a long time for, you know, before we were integrated there.
Right. I know. And I know you just had your State of Manuka address. Is that right?
That's right.
Is the State of Manuka?
We are doing, I think, really well. The water works. When you get done with the water, where it goes works. Mm-hmm. And okay. And the garbage gets picked up. And that's why an awful lot of people don't know where the Village Hall is.
You're doing too good of a job.
Well, that's the biggest three right there.
So, right. And you've been dealing with some transportation issues and some, is it a fast rail or something that's coming through?
Yes, a combination of trains and trucks.
Yeah.
Right next to us, not in our boundary, but right next to our southwest boundary, there's an outfit coming in that's Canadian National, and we had a meeting and they were polite. I'm telling you, I couldn't get over how polite they were. And they said, we're going to give you a gift, 1 million trucks, 1 million semis a year. And we only got one major road. And it's kind of crowded without anything added. So we said, thank you very much, but we can't use it at this time. Well, you can't stop us because federal laws say we can do it. So we sued them. And this is a long story.
But you're working on it.
But anyway, some of the things didn't work out for them, so they said, do you want to settle? And we said, yes.
Okay.
So we're going to get just a fraction of those trucks. They have to go someplace else.
Okay, good job. That's great. Yeah.
Thank you, but it was the lawyers that did it.
And you have kind of, Pawnee has Eagleton. which is the snotty town nearby that they sort of, you know, resent a little bit. But you have Shanahan.
Shanahan is not snotty.
Well, you taught in Shanahan for a long time.
I taught there for 34 years. Yes, I did. We're comparable. We're about the same size.
Okay.
And we share the high school and we share the library district. We don't always agree on everything, but basically we get along pretty well. Mm-hmm. And three of the mayors have been my former students.
Oh, that's great.
Yes.
And that's lovely.
And I brag on them. Only one was indicted.
Good job.
Well done. Well done.
But it wasn't for being the mayor. It was something he did at his business. So.
Well, then you do what you got to do, what you got to do. What part of Parks felt most sort of real to you?
I get in trouble. The people I work with, we're still small. So there's eight other people in the staff for the administrative part. And as you were talking up here, I was thinking, I never tried to compare them to the people, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of comparisons, and they really get along well.
Oh.
It's I get out of bed in the morning, I can't jump anymore, but I'm looking forward to going, because they're all kids, you know, 35, 40, 50 years old, and they know their job. And the reason I get in trouble is that other towns hear it and offer more money. So we've lost some really good people. I don't blame them. It's good for their family.
Right.
You know,
right.
They get a heck of a bump in conditions. So,
yeah.
But I'm just blessed. The only reason I took the job, I ran, is that I went to each one of the people and I said, you got to promise you won't leave if I get elected. The problem is I didn't have them put it in writing. So we've lost, in 5 years, we've lost four really good people. But I'm proud of them, and they did wonderful when I was with them.
I have to ask before we finish, what did you think about Ron Swanson? Not the guy who played him, but Ron Swanson.
What did I think of Nick?
No, what did you think of the character of Ron Swanson?
The character?
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't really realistic. But on the other hand, in the small village, I don't remember if you remember your civics, but there's a lot of different ways you can set up a government in Illinois. In a village, you have six trustees. And they're the actual power. They're the Congress. They're the ones that make the laws, and we try to carry them out. And we've always had at least one person that I don't care what comes up, what the subject is, they say no. All right, so that was Nick, all right?
Yeah.
For 4 years that I was mayor, it was his uncle, my brother-in-law. It's a small town, okay? But, see, Nick wasn't always wrong, and his uncle wasn't always wrong. He always had a good point, and we always learned from it, but we knew, I don't care if it was about a sewer or water or transportation or apple pie, he'd say no. You know, you got to watch out for the pits or, you know, something like that. So he would always have it, but he retired. But we have another one, so.
My final question for you is just, how did you raise such a wonderful son who has really maintained that in Hollywood?
I blame it all on his mother.
Correct answer.
My wife was right.
That's
over
right.
There.
He's really a special man in Hollywood in particular, and kind of brings this Midwest spirit there. I've just been consistently impressed and awed by him throughout this process. So thanks for doing that.
I thank her every day too.
Thanks, Mom. All right, we're going to take some questions. You want to stay up here if people have questions for you too?
Hi. So before the Reddits of the world, there were still fan forums, and there were rumors going around about Parks and Rec because season one was so different, not just Mark, from the rest of the seasons. How much, if at all, did you find out that fan input via these forums or any other ways influenced the rest of the series?
I did not actually hear a ton about fan forums. It's a great question, and I love fandom. Like, I'm upset. I'm a kind of a student of fandom. What did the first season is not great. So I don't know why you're here if like you haven't watched it, but like if you haven't, you could just skip it and go to season two, because they really learned a lot. And the biggest thing they actually had a weird situation in the first season where it's totally usual now for streamers to do this. At that time, it was very unusual. They shot 6 episodes before they aired, and that was the whole season. And so what that means is you're not getting feedback as you go, and you're kind of in a bubble. And then they got a very bad, they felt like it was very bad. It's a mediocre kind of, they do the audience testing, this crazy thing. So they got a not great audience testing. And what the big thing that happened was that it got leaked to Deadline Hollywood. You can still read it to this day online. And I quote a lot of it in my book. And it's a lot of like, I mean, this is how audience testing works. It's crazy where you get like, why isn't she more like Michael Scott from The Office? Why is she so much like Michael Scott from The Office? You know, it's a lot of that kind of thing. They also hilariously said something like they really liked at the end when she got drunk, but she should have been more enthusiastic. Like, they say stuff like this, but they did take this feedback to heart and actually were able to use it to retool what they were about to do for that sixth and final. And I think if you watch it through, if you want to be like a super TV nerd like me, if you watch it through, you can see the step up in episode 6. They figure out a bunch of stuff, and it's mainly like, that's Rock Show, if you're a fan, and they get everyone in a room doing something fun. And this is the first time we see Andy's band play, and they play that hilariously terrible, great song, The Pit. I'm in the pit, you're in the pit, we're all in the pit. Those are the lyrics. And they figured out that was the secret, is getting them to have fun together in a room. And from there, and that's also when they decided to have Chris Pratt as a regular. He had not been. And so it was really more that changed that trajectory into the second, and then they kind of just started to figure it out. And my feeling is the show shows up when Adam Scott and Rob Lowe are cast, and they show up in the final 2 episodes of season 2. I feel like if you watch it through, it's like nice in the second season, you get the penguin wedding, that's cool. But then they show up and you're like, whoa, now we're firing on all cylinders. We've got this beautiful romance about to happen. We have Rob Lowe to look at. It's great. You know, so that was the biggest thing. And from then on, I mean, you can read the book and find out, but they're often just racing against time to try to stay on. And that's actually what ends up making it great, is because they keep saying like, Mike is like, we're not holding back any storylines for later. Everything goes now. That's why Andy and April get married so fast, is because they were going to be a long, slow burn. And instead he was like, we don't know if we're going to be on the air, so let's have a surprise wedding. So it was just a lot of that kept that energy. And Harvest Festival was purely a like thing just to keep them go. Like, we're going to have this big goal at the end of a season, so let's like write toward that because we might not be back. And if you watch that episode, it plays like a finale because it might have been. So you can, and there's a number of them after that are finales that ended up not being finales. And I think that keeps the energy way up.
We have a question from Nevin online. I just want to remind folks, if you're watching online, you can type your questions in the Q&A box. I have a question from Nevin. Were they ever pushed for a Parks and Recreation spinoff?
No, because it wasn't popular enough. No one would have been begging. They were like, Parks was just begging to stay on the air. So NBC was not like, oh, please give us more. You know, they were like, I think they kept it on mostly because it was like, well, at least we know what this is. You bring in a new, they did bring in a new show once called Outsourced and kicked Parks out of its slot for a while, and it tanked. And so I think they got to be so, it was the time when DVRs were just coming in, and there was like cable was just, it's so quaint now, but cable was just coming in and the networks were really panicking and having, it's sort of like a bird in the hand situation. Like, it's not super, super popular, but like, hey, at least we know this thing has fans and we know that it can deliver. So I think that's really what kept it on the air. Young man back there. I know him.
Hello, Jennifer, who I've never met in person before.
My plant.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Good.
Do you have a favorite, like, gag? Like, one gag that you can watch it and it makes you laugh every time?
To be honest, it was this one. Okay. I blew it on that clip. That's like half the episode I made you watch. But I think that is the funniest. It goes on too long. I will take this opportunity to talk about the clip a little bit. That, like, I mean in a good way, right? It goes on just like a little longer than you think the gag is. Like, they're still pushing her up onto the thing from the ice. The other thing, and it was really funny for Allison and me to watch it without, we can't see it for here. We could only hear it. We've both seen it before. And we were like cracking up because even that is funny, but just like, there's so much in it. And also, I think if you wanted to describe this whole show in one sequence, it's this. Because part of the point is that bit, it's a little cheesy, but I love it, is where they kind of say like, oh, we should just go. And they're like, no, we're in this together. And to be honest, it would have gone a lot better if Leslie went alone. Like, we've all kind of like tiptoed on ice. You can do it as a one individual person, but you bring everybody out plus the damn dog that only has three legs, but they insist on being, it's like all for one, right? And that to me is the spirit of the show. The one other thing I want to say about that clip, I could seriously write a book about that clip. The third thing that I love about it is that when she gets up there, when I was first watching it, I think the expected sitcom thing would be for her to say it, to act like it's going well. Right. And it's very Leslie too, right? She's always an optimist. I love that she gets up there and she was like, this is terrible. Like, there's something really great about, like, that's actually pretty brave to be like, this isn't great. This is not going well. And, but then she kind of turns it around, which is very Leslie. And I just think there's so much going on here. And also, they, of course, told me about shooting this and they were like, yeah, we just did it. Like, that's all of us laughing and falling and just, like, letting whatever happens happen. And I think you can see that too. And get on your feet. That's hilarious. And that they only keep playing the one part. I'm like, did you only get rights to just that one part of the? It always cracks me up. Okay.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being here with us, folks. And thank you to Jennifer and to Rick for being here.
Thank you.
I just want to remind folks that if you don't yet have a copy of Parks and Rec, you can get one at the front desk of the museum. If you'd like to get your book signed, we're going to have you line up alongside this wall here, and Jennifer will happily sign your book for you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you, Offermans, actually.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.